This and other podcasts are available on the Gun Rights Radio Network, gunrightsradio.com. Podcasting freedom.
Hello, everyone. This is Bob Main, and you're listening to the Handgun World Show. Why do I carry a gun? Because I can't carry a cop. And thanks for tuning in. This is episode number 81. I got to tell you, I made a mistake. I called last episode number 81. Obviously, last episode was number 80. This is 81. And thanks for tuning in. This is actually recorded quite a bit in advance. Today is Friday, the 20th of August, and I'm going to explain to you in a minute why I recorded this in advance and then waited till now to post it. I am actually driving to Tyler, Texas. For those of you who might be new to the show, let me just tell you, this is a practical show. I'm not a gunsmith or ex-law enforcement or ex-military or a firearms trainer, nothing like that. So I'm going to keep it rooted in simplicity. I just talk about the practical owning and shooting because I'm just a regular guy. As a matter of fact, I'm just a salesman. I'm a Yankee with a gun. I was born in New York City, raised in Wisconsin. I'm going to talk about my home state in this podcast. A couple things about Wisconsin you need to know. And by the way, there's no one in the car with me right now. That's my GPS yakking at me. So I live in Dallas-Fort Worth now, and I am headed to Tyler, Texas for a really cool reason. Tyler's about a two-hour drive from where I live. I'm going to close range gunfighting. That's the name of the training class that I am taking, being put on by Suarez International this weekend. Close range gunfighting. It's their flagship course. It's 2 days long. We're supposed to shoot about 600 rounds, and the title pretty much speaks for itself. We're gonna learn close range gunfighting. I'm imagining we're gonna have some combatives training. That's probably what we're gonna talk a lot about and do a lot, and we're gonna shoot a lot of combatives, most likely. Now, I'm just doing this to kind of give you a little bit of a preemptive look into the class. I will be probably interviewing some people and making it part of this podcast, some other shooters that are there with me. I might interview the instructor if he's willing. Glenn Matthews is the instructor. But I'm almost certain that I will get some interviews with some other shooters there taking the class so you can hear about what they're learning and what they're getting out of it. And, of course, I'm going to do a review of the class as well. Whenever I get a break, I'll dictate a few things. And then when I get back to my hotel room at night, I'll also share with you some of the things that we're covering. So you can get an audio perspective of what happened. I'll try the best I can to get some videos and put it up on YouTube. No guarantee on that, though, but I'll do my best. So I'm headed out to Tyler, Texas. And for those of you who are international listeners or you're not real familiar with where Tyler, Texas is, it's in East Texas, about 2 hours east of Dallas, only maybe, I think, an hour from the Louisiana border. A lot more trees, a lot more humid, a lot more piney woods. And one of the things, here's an insight that I want to share with you as I'm heading out there. The weather for this class. Tomorrow, Saturday, the 21st of August, we're supposed to have a 105 degree heat index. You might be thinking, you know, Bob, why did you schedule a course in late August? Well, I'll tell you, there's a reason I did that. I want to shoot in adverse conditions. I want to do that. I feel like I'm in good enough shape. I'm going to have plenty of good water, good cold water with me. I packed a lot of coolers with water bottles. So I'm going to keep myself well hydrated and well fed. And I've got good shade material. I got good sunscreen, a good hat, and all the stuff that they tell you to bring. I wanted to shoot in adverse conditions. I mean, you know, let's face it, folks. Bad guys are not always going to wait until the weather is good to do something. So part of this is on purpose. 105 heat index tomorrow. It's supposed to cool down a little bit on Sunday, all the way down to 98. Now, for those of you that might live in Arizona and Nevada, you're probably thinking, well, hey, that's nothing, Bob. We're used to that. It's a heck of a lot more humid, muggy, and sticky in East Texas. For those of you who are from Louisiana and Arkansas, you know what I'm talking about. So it's going to be a sweat bath, and I'm going to see what it's like running my equipment, running my gun with sweaty hands. That's going to be interesting and drawing and so forth, but should be a heck of a fun course. Close-range gunfighting is their flagship class. At least Gabe Suarez calls it their flagship class, and I guess, you know, it was probably probably sets the foundation for everything else that they teach. It's probably why they call it that. I don't think I'm going to go into a force-on-force training scenario here. There's been a lot of talk lately on the Gun Rights Radio Network about force-on-force training. So I want to make a few comments about that. Force-on-force is excellent. I want to take an FOF class. I really do. It won't happen this year, but it'll happen sometime next year. I don't think that that's what I'm going to. I think there's going to be a lot of combatives. They're even going to talk about working in a flashlight into our self-defense shooting scenario, so that ought to be interesting. I haven't got that flashlight yet that I want to. But one of the reasons I haven't bought a flashlight yet, maybe by the time you hear this show, I may have a flashlight, a defensive flashlight. And Alex Haddix has sent me some good recommendations, and a lot of you on the forum. By the way, thank you to those of you on the forum for giving me the recommendations on a defensive flashlight. The reason I haven't got it is I want to see what people show up at the class with. I want to see what they're using. I want to see what the instructor recommends. That's going to help me formulate my decision. I've got a pretty good idea. I think I'm going to get a Surefire G2 like Alex Haddix recommended to me. But I'm going to see what they're doing here in this class and how they're handling it and what they're carrying. So anyway, it's a two-day class. It was $350 plus the ammo. And it was close to my house, so that's why I'm going. When these kinds of courses come close to me, it's hard for me to go traveling out of state and spend a whole week at a fancy school somewhere. So this weekend class is going to be good. Here's my philosophy, folks, about training. I've talked a lot about training on this show. I intend to mix the competition sports with, you know, combat and gunfighting training like I'm going to this weekend. I feel that I can shoot an IDPA or a USPSA match the way I want to shoot it. And I want to learn combat training. And I can shoot an IDPA match and I can practice a lot of the skills, probably not all of them, but I can practice a lot of the skills that I'm going to learn this weekend on the IDPA range as long as I keep it safe. That's the key, as long as I keep it safe. I don't break any safety rules when I'm in competition shooting. I've never been disqualified from a match for a safety rule. All right, never even had an accidental discharge. Sometimes I've pressed the trigger when I didn't want to, but my sights were on target. They just weren't quite on target where I wanted them to be. And in the heat of the moment, I pressed the trigger. But I've never violated a safety rule. So there are lots of ways that you can take combat training and you can apply it. And you know, you might not win the match. You might get a procedural called on you here and there. As long as you're keeping it safe, I don't see anything wrong with that. Practice your skills the way you want to practice them. I don't go to IDPA or USPSA matches to win. I'm not a gamer. And I know there's been that term got kicked around the Gun Rights Radio Network forum, and that thread got a little heated there. But that's okay. That's okay, because that's how we learn. Everybody on the forum seems to be real civil, and eventually it seems like everybody kind of respects everybody else's opinions. But, you know I'm not going to be the next Texas State champ. I'm not going to be a grandmaster-level shooter in the competition sports. I don't think I need to be able to properly defend myself, quite frankly. I don't think I have to become an IDPA master shooter in order to be able to defend myself. There are some things about the IDPA game that I really don't care for. That's not for this podcast. I've done other podcasts on that. I might do some others as well. But again, you've heard me be a big encouragement to those of you who are, actually those of you who are relatively new, to get to IDPA matches, because they are great, great avenues for you to get your feet wet. But I plan on mixing the two. Once a year, I have budgeted in my financial budget once a year to go to a class like I'm going to this weekend, a combat training class. So this year, it's Close Range Gunfighting by Suarez International. I'll put a link in the show notes to Suarez International's training schedule in case you're interested. Next year, it's probably going to be a force-on-force. I'd kind of like to go take Tactical Responses Fighting Pistol class that James Yeager and his team put on. I heard a lot of good things about that. I'm a member of their forum over there, getoffthex.com. And those guys seem like they have some pretty good quality training too. I'd love to be able to take a Masad Ayoub class. That might be in 2011 future for me. Not yet sure. But I would strongly recommend, if you own a gun and you are serious, again, I use the word serious, if you're serious about defending yourself, the CHL qualification is a joke, folks. I mean, you are not qualified to defend yourself with a handgun if the only training you have and the only shooting experience you have is what it took to get your concealed carry license. I'm real sorry if that offended anybody. If you want to turn my show off because I just offended you, go ahead. I'm sorry about that. But I have to be honest on this show. I have to give you a good civilian practical view on what it takes to be defended. And I just don't think you can call yourself a well-defended person with a gun if you don't have some semblance of training. So I strongly believe that you get to a course like this once a year. Once a year. Budget it. Instead of buying a new gun, you know, hey, folks, I've been real tempted to buy a new gun this year. But, and I got to give Eric Shelton from the Handgun Podcast a lot of credit. Several weeks ago, he did an episode and he talked about, you know, quit buying guns and get more training. So, Eric, thank you. I've taken that to heart. I'm not going to buy any more guns this year. I would love to. Trust me. I would love to buy another gun. Right? You never have enough guns. But I'm not going to do it. I'm going to invest in myself. I'm the greatest asset that I have. You are the greatest asset that you have. My Tom Hopkins training long time ago taught me that you will generate better returns for yourself than any other investment you can make. So that's what I'm doing, and I'm catching a lot of heat. I caught heat from my family because I'm going to be gone a whole weekend, but this will pay off. This could save my life someday. So for what it's worth, folks, from this average Joe Schmo salesman that does this podcast just because I have a heck of a lot of fun doing it and not making any money doing it just because it's a blast and you keep listening and I keep having a lot of fun doing it, here's my 2 cents for what it's worth. I don't care if you go to a single day basic defensive pistol class. If that's all you can afford and that's all you can budget for, please, I'm begging you to do it. If you want some of my recommendations, I'd be happy to give them to you. Go to Suarez International, check out their schedule. Go to Tactical Response, check out their schedule. Google Masada Ayub's classes, Front Sight, wherever. You know what? There's a local trainer here. There's a local Dallas-Fort Worth area trainer, and he runs a business called Bluffdale Firearms Academy. His name is Steve Moses. And I might even take one of Steve's Moses. I can't talk right now. I might take one of Mr. Moses' classes. It's a one-day class, relatively reasonable. I think it's about $150 in Weatherford, Texas, not too far from where I am. Those of you who live here locally in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, I know there's quite a few of you who listen to me. Go take one of Steve's classes. He's a good trainer. He showed up at IDPA matches, and I see how well this man shoots, and I've caught a glimpse of some of what he teaches. Even that, folks, is a world of difference than just going to IDPA matches or standing at a square range and plinking with a box of ammo once a month. That's not practice. That's not training. Okay, so that's my little glimpse that I wanted to give to you before the training. So that's, I'm going to wrap up segment number one here after the announcements. So the next segment you're going to hear is hopefully some interviews with some students at the class that were there with me. And then hopefully I'll do a recap. You're certainly going to hear me doing a recap of what we learned. But you'll probably hear some students doing an interview. Maybe in segment three you might hear from the instructor or you'll hear from more students. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to interview some people on Saturday, which is tomorrow. I'm going to interview some of them after the first day of the class is over with and kind of get their thoughts, get their opinions. And then I'll try to interview a few more after the second day is over with and kind of compare the two, see how one day differs from the other. So, before the announcements, I want to tell you one more thing because you might be interested in this. What gear am I packing for the class? I'm taking two Glock 19s. Again, you know, because of Steve Z's inspiration, you just heard him on the last show. Two shows ago, my interview with Steve. Z from the forum and a longtime listener. He motivated me to train with my Glock 19 for an entire year, similar to what he's doing. So I own two of them, so I'm packing them. I'm going to take my modified Glock 19, the one I had done by Dale at gripproductions.com. That's on my YouTube channel, by the way. If you haven't listened to, if you haven't watched my YouTube channel, search Handgun World Show on YouTube. There'll be a link in today's show notes, too, about it. I'm taking that with my True Glow TFO sights, and then I'm taking my my other Glock with the... I now have put another set of big dot sights on it. So I'm going to shoot one gun on one day and one gun on the other day. The only difference is one of them I've had grip work done, and it's got different sights than the other. I'm going to try to compare them, see what happens, and we'll just kind of go from there. You know, you never know what can happen at classes like this, and maybe I'll just stick with one gun the whole time. I don't know. And I'm going to work from my Dale Fricke Archangel holster, appendix inside the waistband, since that's my favorite method of carry. And folks, I can't pass up this opportunity to work from appendix inside the waistband. You know, I'm not afraid of it. Some people go, "You got to be kidding, Bob. I can't believe that you would, you know, reholster with with the holster pointing at you know what." I'm not going to speed reholster, folks. There's not going to be a reason for me to speed reholster. If there is, I'm sorry. I'm just going to slow down and take my time and keep my finger off of that trigger and make sure nothing bad happens. The one thing I like about the Dale Fricke Archangel holster is that it's so fast. Somebody emailed me and wanted to know whether I preferred my MTAC, because I have an appendix carry MTAC holster as well, the neutral can, or whether I preferred my Dale Fricke Archangel holster. I definitely prefer the Archangel holster because it is fast. It is a quick draw. And you know what? The retention is excellent. So I cannot pass up this opportunity to train this way, because they're going to allow me to train this way. I can't carry and draw this way at an IDPA match. So now I'm going to get two solid days of it. You know, I can carry at the 330 position and draw from that all the time, and I can go to IDPA and do that. So that's what I'm going to work on this weekend at this class. So I thought you'd be interested in that. And by the way, I just realized I haven't done any listener feedback in quite a while. So I got some good stuff to share with you here before segment number two. I'll wait and do the announcements at the beginning of segment two. I got emailed from, let's see, doggone it, I didn't save the person's name who sent me this email. But I'll put it in the show notes when I find it. He'll know who he is because of the subject matter. But a listener sent me an email saying that he was reading an article in a magazine. And it was about a man in Wisconsin who was open carrying and was stopped by the local police for it. Now, I want to tell you, Wisconsin's an open carry state. It's my home state. And it's, you know, I'm going to pick on my home state for a minute here. They say they're an open carry state, but they're not. When I'm done reading this to you, you're going to say, baloney. They are not an open carry state. They just put it on paper. They don't really mean it. They don't really mean that they want to let citizens open carry, because when you hear how restrictive this is, I don't know how they can, with a straight face, tell people that they're an open carry state. So this guy in Wisconsin was stopped by the police for open carrying. There was a city ordinance prohibiting carry. And by the way, Wisconsin is not a concealed carry state. It's one of only two states that, at least on paper anyway, on paper, says that citizens don't have the right to exercise their Second Amendment rights of carrying a concealed handgun. They say you can exercise your Second Amendment rights open carrying, although they really don't mean it, and they have not passed concealed carry. Perhaps a change in the governor there this November will make a big difference. But anyway, the man unloaded and cased his pistol without citation. After checking, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled the state's preemption statute was violated by the city's ordinance. So this listener typed in Wisconsin handgun laws. Now listen to this. This is the main reason I wanted to share this email with you. Here's Wisconsin's handgun laws. There's five places you cannot open carry. Once again, remember, you cannot conceal carry legally in Wisconsin. There's five places you cannot open carry. One statute says no firearms in state parks and state fish hatcheries unless unloaded and encased or during hunting season with a valid hunting license. Okay, so you can open carry while you're out in the woods hunting as long as you have a valid hunting license. During hunting season, that's it. In state parks and state fish hatcheries. The next statute says you cannot open carry in vehicles either. All weapons in vehicles must be encased and unloaded. Now remember that. Let me say that again. All weapons in vehicles must be encased and unloaded. No firearms in government buildings. Well, okay, that's not a surprise. I think every state's got that. I think that isn't that federal law? Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's federal law. No handguns in taverns or restaurants that serve alcohol for consumption. Now, here in Texas, we have a similar law, and that is the 51% law. In other words, they put the burden on the concealed carry license holder to know whether a business generates 51% of their revenue from alcohol. That's what the statute says. You cannot conceal carry in the state of Texas if the establishment that you're in makes 51% or more of their money from alcohol. Now, how the hell are we supposed to know that? Well, technically, there's supposed to be a 51 sign that they display along with the proper 30-06 statute no carry sign here in Texas. And as long as they have it legally posted, they tell you, supposedly, they tell you that they are a 51%er. In other words, they're getting 51% of their money from alcohol sales. Well, in Wisconsin, this statute is not quite so specific. It says no firearms, no handguns, in taverns or restaurants that serve alcohol. Folks, I got to tell you something. I was raised in Wisconsin. All right? And by the way, I despise Brett Favre. I think he's a... This is a clean program. I want children to be able to listen to this program too. So I'm not going to tell you what I think of Brett Favre. He plays for the enemy now. I'm a Packer fan. Packer fans used to love Brett Favre. Now the vast majority of us despise the man, and hope we lay him on the ground. You know, you remember? I don't know if you. Let me kind of just take a departure here for a minute. I want to have a little bit of fun here on this show. You guys remember that song "Pants on the Ground"? You remember that from American Idol? The dude that tried out for American Idol, "Pants on the Ground," "Pants on the Ground." Well, here's what I'd like to see this year in football season: Favre on the ground, Favre on the ground. Okay. Anyway, I'm done picking on Brett Favre. So anyway, I was raised in Wisconsin. You know what? You can't carry in taverns and restaurants. Do you realize how many taverns there are in Wisconsin? I mean, maybe I got some Wisconsin listeners, so chime in. But there's a lot of taverns in Wisconsin, and everybody goes to them. And I mean, you're weird if you're not hanging at the taverns in Wisconsin. So what are you supposed to do when you're open carrying, right? You can't carry in your vehicle. And you know, so here you go. Here's what you have to do in Wisconsin. By the way, one more statute here of no open carrying. No firearms within 1,000 feet of a school zone unless encased and unloaded. And it says it includes the parking lots of businesses. All right, so basically here's how the open carry law in Wisconsin, this is what it allows you to do. You can walk out of your house open carrying your firearm loaded. Okay, you can walk out of your house, out your front door. As soon as you get to your car, you cannot open the door and sit in your car and pull out of your driveway. You have to unload your firearm and encase it and drive to where you're going. And then wherever you're going, as long as it's not a tavern, as long as it's not within 1,000 feet of a school, as long as it's not at a restaurant where you can serve alcohol, and if it's not where they serve alcohol, and if it's not hunting season, as soon as you get out of your car, then you can uncase your gun, load it back up, strap it on your hip, and go about your business. Now, when you get done, you get back to your car, what do you have to do? Unload the damn thing, put it back in the case, get back in your car, and drive to the next point. Are people going to do that? This is so restrictive that this really is not open carry. All right? And as I mentioned, on paper, they say you can open carry. But you can't. Not practically. So we got a long way to go with gun rights, folks. We really do, and that's why I'm pushing the Freedom Raffle so hard. We still have, we need to file some lawsuits to get rid of some of these restrictions. Okay, next email I want to cover real quick. This came from Mark Vanderberg. And basically, Mark will put out an announcement to the podcasters that the Gun Rights Policy Conference for 2011 is going to be held in Chicago. And he said he thinks it would be fitting to get as many of the network podcasters together. Maybe rent a small room, a small conference room, and we can set up a studio where all of us can do interviewing and podcasting from the Gun Rights Policy Conference of 2011 in September. And he wanted to know if we were interested in going. I'm interested in going. Absolutely. I want to be there, especially because it's in Chicago. So I've already marked my calendar for September 2011. We may do some fundraising drives next year at some point to help raise some money for it. Okay? And since I'm going through these announcements, there's a good chance that there'll probably only be a second segment to this show. And segment three, Sunday's interviews from Close Range Gunfighting, might have to wait. I may post another one about 3 days later, which is just an addendum to this show. But I want to get some of the listener feedback out, because I do read all your emails, folks, and I will address everything on the shows. Sometimes it takes me a while, because I'm getting so many of them now, but I will address them. Dave writes to me and about the low-light IDPA episode that I recently did. And he was talking about lights, and he turned me on to some Phoenix lights and O-lights. And he sent me a link to his Phoenix Digital PD30, which looks like a pretty cool light. It's priced right, and that might be one that I'll pick up. That looks like kind of a cool little tactical flashlight. But somebody also on the forum made a good point that Surefire lights that he said... in fact, it was Recon on the forum. Hey, Recon, I want to give you a shout-out and say thanks for giving me some good advice on flashlights. He said, pay attention to the light disbursement, how it's dispersed. Even though it may have a lot of lumens, if it's not dispersed properly, it's not going to do you a lot of good. That's one of the things I don't like about my Glock tactical rail-mounted light. I don't like the way it disperses light. I mean, I've practiced with it and gone into dark rooms and things and dry-fired practiced with that light. I don't like the way it lights up the room. I just don't care for it. I don't like the way it lights up the target. So, good suggestion, Recon. And Dave, thanks for giving me the info on the Phoenix light. Peter from New Jersey also writes... Now, hang on, folks. I got to get my reading glasses on, because this one's in small print. Just a second. Okay, quick pause there. I got my reading glasses. For you younger listeners to this show, be thankful you're not in reading glasses yet. This is no fun, especially when I'm driving. Don't worry, I'm being safe. I got my show notes right here on the wheel, and I got both hands on the wheel while I'm able to do this, folks, so I am being a safe driver. So Peter from New Jersey says to me that he was listening to my podcast about low-light shooting, and that he was in a very challenging shooting condition the other day, and he wanted to tell me about it. He said he was in New Jersey the other night, and he was shooting a Beretta 9mm outdoors at a local shooting club. It was about 7 o'clock at night, and it was about 90-plus degrees and very high humidity. I can relate to that. All of the shooters on the line were sweating a lot, probably like I'll be doing in the 105-degree heat this weekend. The guns were getting very slippery, and sweat was rolling down into your eyes, and the shooting glasses were fogging up. It was very uncomfortable and challenging, and I could clearly tell my shooting was off, but I continued to shoot as a good real-world practice session. And that comes from Peter in New Jersey. Great point, Peter. Thanks for sending me this. Again, this is exactly one of the reasons why I wanted to take this course this weekend in the blistering heat, because it'll help me practice shooting in adverse conditions, and that's important. I want to make sure that I train on that. All right, so that wraps up the listener feedback. Folks, if I forgot to talk about your email on the show, remind me that I didn't talk about it. I'll talk about any email you send me, good, bad, or indifferent. I don't care. As long as it's clean. If you send me profanity, I'm obviously not putting it on the show or not going to talk about it. But if it's clean and it's constructive, and folks, don't always agree with me, please. guys don't always agree with me. Please send me some. I need some more feedback from those of you. I know you're out there. I need some more feedback from those of you who think that I'm all full of BS on some of this stuff. I know you're out there, and I know that I'm full of some BS on some things. I have to be. A guy like me, as opinionated as me, I got to have some BS in me somewhere. So call me on it, all right? Please. So that's the end of segment one. 15 seconds of music, a commercial break for the Gun Rights Radio Network, and by the time I come on segment number two, I obviously won't be driving. I will be bringing you some information from the close range gunfighting class.
The forums are a great place to interact with the podcasters and other listeners to your favorite podcast. Visit GunRightsRadio.com and click on the forums button at the top of the page and sign up for your free membership. GunRightsRadio.com.
All right, folks, segment two. Welcome back to the show. I'm in my hotel room in Tyler, Texas. It's Saturday, August 21st. Just finished up day one of close-range gunfighting with Suarez International. Glenn Matthews, instructor. Glenn's a great guy. If you get a chance to take one of his courses or any of the SI courses, you'll be real pleased. So here is a summation of day one. A fellow shooter named Paul was very kind enough to interview with me and talk about what we've worked on this first day. The good news is you're going to hear about a lot of good combative techniques that we talk. And, of course, folks, this is nothing like competition shooting. This is combat training here, or at least it's the start. No force-on-force, though. This is not a force-on-force class, just some good combatives with handguns. The disappointing thing, there was only seven shooters or seven people here taking the class. The good thing is that means we all get much better personal attention. I wish there was more people that did this, but that's the way it goes. So here you go. It's kind of choppy. It's going to be, but I'm going to play them all back to back. Three or four segments here of what we did today in day one of close range gunfighting. So here's Paul and I talking about it from the shooting range. Here you go.
Wait a minute. I'm with Paul. Okay. So we started off with the basic marksmanship trial.
Started off at 3 yards.
Yeah.
Worked our way back to 20 yards at various intervals.
Wait, that was when we first started out. Okay, that was just testing marksmanship. Okay.
Right. Started at 3, worked our way back to 20 yards, firing single shot center of mass.
Okay.
Then we went ahead and we went to the shooting from the shooting from retention position.
Yeah. Two to the body, one to the head.
Just two to the body. Starting off with the gun tucked into the rib cage.
Yes.
Making sure we've got turned out to the side just a bit so we don't catch the slide in our clothing or anything.
That's right.
And then going two to the body. From there, worked once again, started at 3 yards, worked our way back to 20, and a lot of us discovered that shooting without the use of your sights can make things very, very entertaining.
Well, you know, in fact, when we did that, I learned that I can actually put two at 3 yards center of mass without any sights. Not too bad.
But when you get back to 20 yards...
When I got back to 20, forget about it. Yeah. But as we say in New York, forget about it.
Yep. Then we went from shooting from the 2 position to the 3 position. Yeah. Off of a 5-count.
What's the 3 position?
3 position is when you're, I've always heard it as low ready. When you got both hands on the gun is tucked into your sternum, and it's right before you extend it all the way out to either 4 or 5, depending on the draw count
right.
you're using.
Right.
So we started once again the same thing. Once again, no sights, having to index, making sure the gun's parallel to the ground, backing our way from 3 yards all the way back to 20.
That's right. Glenn, the instructor, told us about making sure it's parallel.
Exactly. One of the things I started to see on my target was that sometimes the second shot would go a lot higher than I had intended, and sometimes a little bit wild because you're looking at your target, not necessarily at your gun. It's very, very easy for that gun to get either out of the index of your body or to get away from parallel. Next thing you know, you're shooting a lot higher than
you are. Good point. Okay, I'm glad we're talking about this so I can remember it.
Then from there, we went to... We started working with the target itself. We went ahead, talked about the if you're in tight on the guy or the guy's tight on you, and has got a weapon of some sort or is just very, very aggressive, getting an open hand or a closed fist and popping them in the face, keeping the hand up on the head. In this case, we used it on the target for a couple of reasons. We're 2 feet away. We're actually not even 2 feet away. We're pretty much, we're touch close. I mean, for some of us, that's just 2 feet. So all of a sudden, you're shooting from that range. You're making sure you're getting your weak hand.
Your weak hand up there in front of his face.
Up and out of the way of your own barrel. And then we went ahead and did the same thing, two shots from the retention position. And one of the things that Glenn pointed out was those shots were going to naturally go low simply because we were in so tight to the body. We didn't have time really to rock the gun.
We actually wanted it to go low, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
We wanted to shoot those body shots low.
Right, going into the pelvic area.
In the pelvic area.
And then we went ahead. Once we'd done that, we pretty much destroyed the targets with that bit, put up fresh targets, and then we went to the Mozambique drill, in which we fired two shots center mast and one shot to the head.
That's right. That was fun.
That was fun. The stipulation on this, though, was a little bit different. Well, you started from the retention position, from the two position, firing two shots to the body, and then you had to decide what you're going to do with your head shot. And he talked about the fact that when you're 3 yards in, you really don't have the option to extend out and use your
sight. It's not smart to extend your gun out.
Exactly.
Because you're promoting a gun grab.
Pretty much. Now, and I can see where he's coming from, but I'm also thinking to myself, well, I just shot him twice in the center of mass.
He might not be able to grab.
He might not be able
You never know, though.
But you never know.
Right.
And also, he brings up another option of, you know what, maybe I did shoot him twice. Why not start backing away to make it safer to extend? But that wasn't that drill. This drill, once again, two shots to the body, one to the head. And trying to do it without sights, that's a problem. And then he said basically he gave us the option to back, as we backed away from the target, to use whatever sighting method or whatever grip rent
to raise the gun up
we wanted to use. So some of us started going from two, some started going from three. But basically once we hit 5 yards, I think pretty much everyone was, for the final headshot, we were very concerned about getting the gun all the way extended out to our 5-count range and making sure we had sights on target to go ahead and put a good clean shot to the head.
That's right. Yeah, I remember.
One of the courses I went on, they had us trying to do headshots from 15 yards, and the instructor on that one said the point of that was to disabuse us of the Hollywood notion that someone...
To do what?
To disabuse us of the Hollywood notion
okay.
that you're going to go ahead and do some heroic hostage rescue shot by some guy grabbing a victim and holding him in front of him, putting the gun to their head, and you're going to somehow hit him in the head and knock them out from behind them.
How did that work?
We discovered, and we actually had two targets up there. We had the actual target up there. A lot of us wound up either missing the bad guy completely or hitting the hostage. The head-sized target from 15 yards under a time frame, Especially under stress, that's a difficult target to shoot. And that kind of brings up a good point, one that Glenn had also brought up of, you know, if you've got cover around you, you need to go run to cover instead of standing there and getting a gunfight with
Absolutely.
Somebody. I know I saw a video of Clint Smith of Thunder Ranch talking about vehicle defense. Yeah, his point was, you know, you're in your car, drive away.
Exactly.
Why get out of the car?
Your car is a weapon, too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a 3,000-pound bullet.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, why, you know, and I think a lot of the problem people get into is, I'm carrying a gun, I'm 10 feet tall, I'm going to go looking for trouble, you know.
Bad move.
Exactly, you know. I've talked to a lot of people who started carrying concealed, and they said they got a lot more aware of avoiding trouble at all costs because they just realized how exponentially...
Yep.
Difficult things can get. I mean, you know, most people don't talk about this, but if you get involved in a shooting, you're probably going to spend $30,000 to $40,000 on lawyer's fees, even if you did the right thing.
You better have good lawyers and good insurance.
Yeah, pretty much. So, you know, so that it brings up some pretty good topics, you know, and the problem is we grow up, especially in the entertainment world, you know, you get these misguided notions of what you're going to be able to do with a sidearm or... Well, you know, this is good stuff to kind of bring you back to reality on it.
Exactly. So, Paul, this first half a day here at Close Range Gunfighting, what did you take away from the first half a day?
I think from the first half a day, number one, dress in shorts from the morning.
And drink a lot of water.
Make sure you've been drinking a lot of water, plenty of previous stuff. I think the difficulty of trying to shoot when you're not using the sights.
I agree. That was hard.
Without a doubt. You know, you become much more aware of your body position. The position of the gun in relation to your body, because it's real, real easy to, and I found myself doing this a couple times, going through mag changes. As I'm reloading, I bring the gun back. I might not have gotten back on to exactly where I needed to be, and the problem is I'm not looking at the gun. I'm looking at the target.
I found that too. I didn't come back to the same position that I was in, you know, because I'm so used to shooting, looking at the sights. So I got a lot from this shooting with no sights thing too.
Shooting with no sights, and you start to be very aware of your, I guess, control of the gun, especially when you've only got one hand on the gun. I'm using a 45. I've got that thing tucked into my ribs, and from 3 yards away, I might hit a guy in the side of his left, you know, left rib cage, and then my next shot, just barely a split second later, might be, you know, 2 feet the other direction.
Right.
Still shots on target, but all of a sudden you start to become aware of how difficult it really is to hit something with a handgun.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you're using your Les Baer 45. How's that working?
Works very, very well for me. I know it's kind of funny because you know, everyone here except for me is shooting a Glock.
We're not picking on you.
No, but that's understandable. You know, and that's just one of those things. I'm very, very comfortable with the 1911 platform. For me, it shoots very naturally.
Good.
I have a Glock. Actually, I travel with a Glock because, you know, if the airline loses my luggage, you know, I can replace my Glock.
You haven't lost a $1,500 handgun if they do.
Exactly. You know, and all the points that they were making about, you know, and they talked about, you know, hey, you got to choose a gun that's going to work for you.
Exactly.
For me, Glocks point unnaturally low, so it's not exactly the easiest thing for me to deal with. The transitions there, I read about a course that Ken Hackthorne and
Larry Vickers
ran.
Yep.
You know, you got two of the foremost 1911 experts in the world, and they're sitting there saying, look, the 1911 is a dying platform. You know, these guys are saying, you know, you're going into a hot spot somewhere, you're going to carry a Glock, simply because outside of America, it's a 9mm in Glock world.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people don't realize that. Outside of America, it pretty much is. You know, I would say the 1911 is probably still the quintessential American gun.
It is, without a doubt.
Yeah, but outside of America, you're right.
It's you're not going to find one. So, you know, you're going into trouble somewhere, and these guys both said, you know, you carry a Glock 17. That being said, I think the best way to explain it, and I've heard various ways to say it, I think the best way to explain the 1911 is an enthusiast's gun.
That's right.
If you've got, my dad loves old cars. You know, he'll get out there with those little British MGs or Triumph Spitfires, and he loves to tool around on them and play with them and fiddle with them, and that's basically what the 1911 is. One of the things Vickers says is that if you're going to treat your gun like you treat your lawnmower, get a Glock. You know, 1911's got
good point.
Yeah, 1911's got to be cleaned weekly. Got to be detailed, stripped monthly.
You got to treat a 1911 like you treat your BMW. Treat your Glock like you treat your Honda.
Absolutely. You're not gonna take your classic car for a spin down to the grocery store to get milk. You're gonna hop in the minivan and do that. You know, the minivan gets a little bit beat up. You're not too concerned about that. You know,
that's
but
true.
You get a little scratch on the Jag XJ120, and you're gonna be having fits about that. But you know, that's some good points you brought up. But you know, there's modern weapons, modern ammunition.
Right.
You know, you way out once upon a time when all you had was ball ammunition. You know, 9mm might not have been the best.
No, choice. Then 45 was the choice when you only had ball ammo.
Absolutely. You know, one of the best ways to look at it is like if you've got, you know, modern defense rounds, you know, 9mm is a good way to go for a lot of people. If all you got access to is ball, 45 is probably the better choice.
Yeah. And nowadays, you know, with the modern hollow points and the high-tech ammunition that we have, you know, it's kind of an equalizer of the ammunition. Would you agree?
Yeah, it really pretty much is. And also, I think, you know, you can read the various stories, and we talked a little bit about some of the ones who shot multiple times with, you know, handguns and still survived. You know, that's very much a rarity. A lot of people get shot, they're going to feel it.
Oh, yeah, they're going to have a bad day.
Absolutely. You know, and yeah, maybe you happen to come across the unlucky one in a thousand who gets shot, and, you know, it doesn't have any effect on him, or the guy catches the bullet in his teeth, and then it pretty much isn't going to matter what kind of caliber you're carrying. You've got
Absolutely.
A whole other host of problems.
Absolutely. Now, just from my own memory when I listen back to this, you're the guy from Grand Prairie, aren't you?
Grapevine.
Grapevine, Texas.
There we go.
Yeah, which isn't very far. I'm in Frisco. Paul's in Grapevine. So we each had easy drives to get out here. We only live about 21 miles away from each other, right?
Yeah, probably about that. Now, of course, talking about Dallas traffic, it depends on the time of day.
21 miles. It could be 90 minutes, it's 20 miles.
90 minutes, but it really is 20 miles.
All right, thanks for helping me remember the first half day of close-range gunfighting. Now, when this day is over, let's talk about what we did in the second half of the day.
Absolutely.
Right. Thanks, Paul.
Good deal.
Paul, we got to talk about Sewell. Sul is Portuguese for south, right?
That's correct. They developed it in Brazil when they decided that when you had guys running into a dangerous area, you wanted to have your buddies right behind you, but at the same time, you don't want to have them shooting you in the ass.
So we learned in this half day, we learned defending the Sul, which is...
We learned applying the Sul.
Applying the Sul. Excuse me. Oh, well, hey, you know what? Defending the Sul sounds better.
Yep.
Applying the Sul.
Basically, when you're using the Sul position, what that allows you to do is allows you to scan the area around you without sweeping everybody with the muzzle of your gun.
Right.
That's very, very important because, you got people around you. All they know is they've seen a shooting and some lunatic with a gun's now pointing it at them. The police will become very interested in
you. So how do you do let's kind of describe as
basically
best we can.
With the Sul, you take your gun in your strong hand. We're right-handed, so we're going to go ahead and assume that.
Right.
You'll place your left hand on your chest.
On your chest?
About sternum.
Right.
Your gun hand will come right directly on top of...
The knuckles.
On top of that hand. The barrel will be laid facing directly down across the knuckles, and you can think of it as your two thumbs forming a nice... Your two thumbs and your fingers forming a nice little square, a little diamond shape,
exactly.
Right smack dab in the middle of your chest.
With your muzzle
going
right down the knuckles of your weak hand.
Exactly, and pointing right in between your
feet. On top of the knuckles, yes.
Right,
and then that way your muzzle is not pointing at you or at anybody else.
Absolutely, one of the real big tendencies you have a lot is you slap this thing in, and maybe your hand's not completely flat, so you got your muzzle pointed off, and as you're turning, next thing you know, you're sweeping the guy next to you in his shins.
You turn 360,
yep.
And then you're not sweeping anybody with your muscle.
Absolutely.
Your muzzle.
The steps we go through is pretty simple. The drill we did, we fired, we started on the move again, moving on to 9 o'clock or 3 o'clock from concealment. We, on his count, we moved, then drew. Make sure you get yourself out of the way first.
Right. Get off the X first.
That's right.
Then draw your gun.
Fire two shots to center mass, then as many shots as needed to get a good headshot.
Good headshot.
And then from there, you went ahead, you dropped your muzzle low.
Mm-hmm. Scan right.
Scan left, scan right.
Scan left and right.
Scan left and right. From there, you take a step forward with one of your feet. Whichever one you choose is up to you. My personal thing is, I've already got my left foot forward as I'm shooting. That's the easiest thing
for me. I use my right. But
whatever
works.
Whatever works for you. You step forward and then you turn.
Put your gun in Sul.
Turn and scan the entire area.
Right.
One little tip he gave was if you look down low, that opens up your peripherals because now all of a sudden you're having to really be aware of everything out there.
Yeah, let's key in on that. A lot of people, when they check their left and check their right, they pick their head up too much.
Exactly.
If you keep your head pointing towards the ground, you got better peripheral vision.
Absolutely. So once you've gone ahead and you swept behind, you return to the target, you extend the firearm back out towards the target, reassessing them, making sure he's still down. At that point, you start to assess yourself, still keeping your gun up on the target. Make sure you haven't got any holes or red stuff leaking out of you.
Uh-oh, the red stuff's coming out.
At that point,
not good.
You go ahead and you reload your firearm. Now, a lot of people have a tendency to do this. They drop their head, they look down, the gun comes down.
That's a
no-no.
Next
thing you know, you're sitting there and you can't see what's going on. You want to keep your head up there. You want to keep the gun pointed forward.
At the target. Keep your eyes on the target while you're reloading.
Exactly. The gun comes up in front of your face. This is sometimes called the workspace. So you can
Correct.
See here. You can see beyond it.
Correct.
You go ahead. You take your magazine. You put it in your pocket because you still got bullets in there.
Right.
Reload. The point behind that is
you retain the mag with the bullets in case you need them.
In case you need it again.
And right.
Then the second thing you want to make sure is you've got a fresh mag. For those of you who carry the Glocks with the Hollywood clips and 33 rounds, kind of overkill.
The Happy Six won't fit in my pocket.
Exactly. For someone like me with only 8 rounds, I'm going to go ahead and make sure
that's because you got one of those 1911s.
That's right.
A nice one though, a Les Bear.
Yep.
All right.
Yep,
all right. So anyway, after we've done... Okay, so that's what we worked on.
Yep.
And we just kept repeating that over and over. I think we did it 5 or 6 times.
Repetition.
It. That's the key.
I once heard it described, there's no such thing as advanced gunfighting tactics. It is the basics done very, very, very well.
I like that. Thanks, Paul.
No problem.
All right, so in the last segment, what did we do? We started off with what?
Started off moving side to side with shooting on the targets. Three steps left and three steps right, making sure obviously that we all step the same direction.
Right.
A couple points they made on that is if you're right-handed and you're traveling to your left, you can go ahead, you can drop your weak hand off the gun and just use your strong side.
Strong hand
tracking the gun. If you're right-handed and you're going to your right, that becomes a problem because, you know, trying to run with two hands on the gun can get a little bit iffy.
Right.
You can try it, and I tried it, and it worked for me. The other option you have is to transition the gun to your weak hand.
Right, that was easier.
And shoot it off that. I stuck with just both hands on the gun.
You did?
Yeah, I did. And I found I was a little bit more accurate with it. From there, we went to going to one-handed shooting with the weak hand.
Okay.
And one of the things that they came up with that and made a couple of points on is that if you're shooting one-handed, you want to go ahead and you want to, lead with the foot that you're shooting the same hand with, and you want to lean into the gun even more than normal because you don't have both hands on it. You've really got to make sure you do a lot to get your body behind it.
Now, I found that's what I was not doing well enough. I was not leaning well enough.
Yeah.
And the more I leaned into it, the more accurate I was, especially with the weak hand.
Absolutely. The other thing they brought up on that was what they call the half homie hold.
Oh, half homie.
Go ahead and cant the gun to 45 degrees off center and does a couple things. Number one, and for me, I'm right eye dominant. Shoot with your left hand, that can get a little bit odd.
Yeah, it is.
But by canting it to 45 degrees, I found it really brought the sight very, very well underneath into my eye line. Other thing it did was the stress on the muscular system supporting is a lot less keeping it at that 45 degree cant than if you're trying to hold the gun straight up and down.
Yep.
A couple points they also made, let me see, take a look at this. We also worked on drawing from the holster, taking a look at that, the different contact ranges. The different ranges you're shooting from. Talking about going from concealment, make sure you get your weak hand on the garment, get it up, and get it all the way out of the way.
Yeah.
You know, over exaggerate how far you're going to do it, because once you're trying to go fast, next thing you know, you're pulling your gun out and you've got it tangled up in your shirt, and you know, you're blowing holes in yourself instead of the gun.
Well, and where that comes into play is when you're reholstering.
Absolutely.
Making sure you're keeping that garment out of the way.
Absolutely. And one of the things they made the point of was to reholster reluctantly.
Reholster reluctantly.
So a lot of guys will get their gun out and they'll shoot and they'll have their gun back in the holster before the gun fires.
You know, I was doing that in the first segment today of this class. I was reholstering real quick. And the big thing I learned is I don't have to reholster quickly.
Yeah.
Reluctantly. I like that. Reholster reluctantly.
One point he made was, like you said, making sure you don't get the covering garment caught in the shirt as you're going back in.
Exactly.
You know, Murphy's Law is going to go ahead and set that trigger off.
Happens every time.
That's one thing that I found kind of, you know, we were talking about the use of Glocks and everything, and yeah, they're a good weapon design, but the fact that you got that safety right on top of the trigger, you've got to be absolutely sure every time. There is nothing else in that trigger.
Keep that finger out of the trigger.
And, you know, like you said, not even just the finger, but the cloth and clothing material.
And the cloth out. Yeah, that. Exactly. That's right.
We worked the same thing at contact range, same thing we did this morning. Problem is, how do you draw concealed there? Well, you can't go one-handed, so we talked about get the gun out first, then get the hand up, slap the guy back. So make sure, though, you're getting that covering garment up out of the way with your weak hand. You draw the weapon with the right, get that left hand up in his face, smack him in the nose.
After the gun is cleared, the holster.
After the gun is cleared.
Right.
And then go from there.
Yeah.
Some people might argue, well, you know what, you get your hand up in his face, maybe they don't see the gun coming. If you draw first, they know what's coming. Here's the thing. If he's bringing his hands down to his gun, you can still shoot him in the kneecaps.
Yes, that's right.
The issue you really come across is, you know, if you try and go too fast at the same time, next thing you know, you're doing the two-step tango with your gun underneath your shirt, and you're never quite sure what you're pointing on there.
That would not be much fun.
That's true. Other point they made, another key thing they made a point of, when you're bringing your support hand up when you're doing weak-handed shooting, make sure you bring that support hand up from the bottom of the gun to wrap around.
Mm-hmm.
And the point they made was, if you're doing it with your weak hand and you bring your hand over from the side, there's a tendency of that thumb to wrap over the top of the wrist.
Your weak hand thumb will wrap over the wrist, and then you're going to get nailed by the slide.
Absolutely. So you want to make sure you get, you know, the way I had explained to me was that whatever side you're shooting on, whatever hand you're using, you got both hands on the gun, you want your thumbs in the two dogs humping position. You know, you got to have those two things right on top of each other.
Yep. All right. Good.
There you go.
Okay, that wraps up this show. We did a day two. Day two is going to be in the next show. I'm going to post another podcast in about two or three days. And all it's going to be is just Paul and I again, maybe a couple of other shooters, talking about what we did in day two of close range gunfighting. So I'd love to play it for you now, but you're going to have to wait a couple of days. I just don't want these podcasts to drag on too long. It'll give you something to look forward to a couple of days from now anyway. And so just be checking your feeds, be checking iTunes. Probably 2 days from when you hear this is when I'm going to post the next one. So, with that said, I'm going to go ahead and let you go, folks. As Eric Shelton likes to say, quit buying guns and get some training, and this is a phenomenal training experience. Talk to you again. Tune in the next episode. I guess that'll be episode number 82 for day two of close range gunfighting. Talk to you later, folks. And the reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop. Thanks.